So they were now to live in a small minority group within an environment which they found sometimes threatening, sometimes friendly, but largely alien to their culture and to their religious faith. I think that could be a comment about the church here and now. But in fact, it refers to the exiles in Babylon at the turn of the 7th century BC. What the prophet Habakkuk had foreseen had occurred. The nation of Judah had been overrun. Some of its inhabitants had been taken off to Babylon. It would have been a great shock to many of them. They expected David's line of succession to run forever. They didn't expect the temple to be violated. And it's actually more than 3 centuries since the heady times of King David and King Solomon. The kingdom known to Solomon has been split into two. We have Judah and we have Israel. There have been some good kings, but also a number of very bad kings. Sorry, I think one of my slides has come out of order, actually, but okay. They're out of order for some reason. Right, so Judah had fallen to the Babylons 3 centuries after David and Solomon. And the people had been unfaithful to God. There had been good kings, there had been bad kings, and so on. And some of these people had been taken off to Babylon. And many more would join them in the following times. There's a book written by Viv Thomas called Second Choice, Embracing Life as It Is. And it's Eugene Peterson who remarks in his preface to that book, he says, "We are glutted with information, but we are starved for wisdom. We know so much about everything under the sun, but we live astoundingly trivial lives." Why? Why do we know so much and live so badly? Well, partly at least because as a culture we are admiring all the wrong people. We admire influencers and sports stars whose behavior is increasingly bad. And we've lost touch with wise people as well. One writer actually describes Andrew Jackson, the 7th US president, as being the impossible hero. That's a debatable thing if you actually look into the history of it. But we could actually genuinely ascribe that idea to Daniel in many ways. But of course, it's not just about Daniel. Daniel provides the willingness, he provides the obedience, but it's God that provides the support and the power behind that. And Daniel made what was at best his second choice location a very stunning success. Now, to put Daniel chapter 1 into historical context, we know that there were power struggles throughout the 7th century BC. There was a long reign of Manasseh in the early part of the century. Judah was subject to Assyrian overlords. Then for a while, as Babylon grew in power, Judah had a brief period of independence. Then they came under the control of Egypt in 610. And finally, with the defeat of Egypt at the Battle of Carchemish, then they came under the control of the Babylonians. And then later that year, as recorded in verses 1 to 2 of Daniel chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar goes to Jerusalem and he ends up taking not only its temple treasure, but its human treasure, some of its young royals, to Babylon. And the first point here, and you'll have to excuse me popping back and forward here because is to see how Daniel was actually understanding this. And the first point, he understands it, if you read that passage, is that it's God who has delivered the people into the hands of Babylon. That is Nebuchadnezzar's hands. And the articles that are taken from the temple are mentioned there because of their importance to the people of Judah and, of course, Israel. And Nebuchadnezzar certainly considers them treasure, but he doesn't abuse them, as we see later in chapter 5, as Belshazzar does. But they're no more valuable to him than the rest of his treasure. If he believes in God at all, it's of the God of Daniel at all. It's only as one of a great pantheon of gods. And the whole way that the Babylonians thought of their gods was different from the way that Israel thought of the true God. They had myths and so on, which imagined these gods evolving out of the material universe. Whereas we know that our God is spirit, that he's external to the universe in which we live. But we should stay a moment with the idea that God is control, even in these very sad and trying circumstances that Daniel and his three friends were facing. And it's important for us when we face our own personal trials as well, difficulties and challenges. And they're there on a more global scale. As Tim indicated earlier, we look at a world that seems out of control. We've got a despot in the East, in North Korea, and with apologies to Tim, the oddest looking and the most worrying US president ever. Continuing conflict in the Middle East. War in Ukraine. Murders even of children in our major cities. We've got terror incidents on the doorstep. We've had them reported recently. There's a rising challenge, isn't there, in political correctness. It's one thing to make half the population feel involved by using neutral pronouns when we can. It's another thing to do what sometimes we are asked to do. And we have at times it's a very intolerant liberalism, if that makes sense, that challenges our right to hold on to our faith and to speak about it. Now, clearly, God does not approve of an awful lot of what goes on in our world. Most of the time, I can only suppose that he's got so much respect for our free will that he allows us to go our own way, make our own mistakes, although when necessary, he does intervene. He's referred to as acting directly in some way in verses 2, 9, and 17, if you look at the passage. Now, he didn't rescue Daniel and his three friends from that situation. He didn't suddenly spirit them out of Babylon and back to Jerusalem. But he did intervene. He gave them the strength to live in that situation, which was very much a second-choice world for them. And I don't know whether you realize, but they were only teenagers. The estimates for Daniel's age range between 14 and 17 years old. They were in a place that wasn't home, with people they hadn't chose to be with, and in a place with a very different culture and different language. Now, that may well be true for missionaries in some places today, but they've chosen to go there. Daniel had no choice. And God had frequently warned the Jewish people, as a whole nation, what would happen if they failed to honor him and his commands. And now it happened, and these young men were in exile because of the bad behavior of others. And sometimes, and to some extent, we also find ourselves in a second choice situation. But the good news is that we can too also find strength to live in that second choice world. God is there and he's ultimately in control. But I do want to take you through a few things that Viv Thomas suggests in his books. This is about having a fantasy that things will be different. So the first one is, if you walk closely with God, he'll give you your first choice in everything. Well, has anybody experienced that? Nope, can't see any hands. The second one, in my first choice world, I will be happy. Well, you might for a little while, but time moves on, things change, they may not be quite as you expected them to be. In my first choice world, I will be secure. Again, things move on, things change, there are no guarantees. And in my first choice world, I will be able to walk close to God. Well, I wonder if that's really true. I wonder if it isn't equally likely or more likely that you're likely to move away from God as everything goes smoothly and so on, if you never have to face any other difficulties. So let's move on. And I'll have to excuse me going backwards because one of them's in the wrong order. Okay. So, the first point is that for his time, Nebuchadnezzar was actually quite an enlightened ruler. I mean, in many ways, we regard him with great horror, but for his time, he was quite enlightened. He didn't go through trying to oppress the people that he actually conquered and captured. He probably recognized quite wisely that that would just lead to a string of rebellions. Instead, he sought to integrate them into the society of Babylon. And this is why he wants to include the best and the brightest in his administration, because those people will better understand the attitudes and the mindset of the people that he's captured. Did Daniel and his three friends take an IQ test? Well, probably not, but we do, and we have absolutely no idea, but they're identified as showing an aptitude for learning. They're being well-informed, and they're quick on the uptake as well. And so this man, Ashpenaz, is charged with overseeing a Babylonian education. It's going to be something like a 3-year university course if we try and translate it into our terms. And it begins with them being given new names. I don't know about you, how would you feel if suddenly somebody gave you a new name? I hadn't really said anything to people who do it, but I'm really quite a little bit peeved when people shorten my name. There's only 6 letters in it, and some of them are going to only manage 4. But there's no indication that Daniel or his friends objected. They probably didn't like it, but they made no fuss. And actually, there's a precedent for that earlier in the Bible, where Joseph makes no fuss about being given a new name in Egypt. And it's interesting, if we look forward to Daniel chapter 5, his original name is still known, and that is decades later. Anyway, the opportunity to have such an education in secular terms anyway would have been a great honor, a great privilege, nothing to worry about, having the best food and drink. But the whole process bears a little bit of resemblance to brainwashing, as we would call it. But there's only one issue in the next few verses where the friends seem to object. They take up this new opportunity, they perform exceptionally well. And there is a reason for that. And that is that they were aware of a letter from Jeremiah. And I'm going to quote from you, Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 4 to 7. Where it says, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and have sons and daughters, take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters, multiply there and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. So their attitude was to be that which is espoused in general in the New Testament, where they're urged to live at peace with all in as far as they can, but also not to conform to the pattern and the ways of the world, which are in conflict with God's will. And one commentator asks the question, are we not resident aliens, singing of a God the world doesn't know, considering Sunday as a day for rest and worship rather than for shopping and sport? Are we raising our families differently? Are we behaving towards our employer differently? Are we actually out of joint with our times? And if that is so, then Jeremiah's advice applies equally for us today. And in order to seek the welfare of the place where we live, it's actually necessary to know something about it, just as Daniel and his friends needed to know about Babylon. We need to understand the world at large, and particularly our part of it, our community. And we need to understand the church community and ourselves as well. And all of that requires some effort and some study. So we might be moved to volunteer in some way, to be involved in something outside of church. Always remember that Chris Bennett, the previous minister at the church, actually deliberately went and I think played music with other people because he felt that he had no non-Christian contact otherwise. And we should thank God for the involvement of Christian people in all sorts of areas of our world, even politics. We should be asking ourselves the question, what does it mean for us to seek the welfare of the city in which we live, in exile? However, being involved and seeking the welfare of the place where we clearly are doesn't mean conforming with all the practices of the world. Instead, we'd be seeking to transform it and to have our mindset transformed, as we learn in Romans. We can best protest against things and work for change, though, if in as far as we can be, we are participants rather than being wholly outsiders. And we will find ourselves confronted on various issues, just as Daniel was. And we need to decide when to go with the flow and when to take a stand. One commentator puts it like this: today, a situation is arising in many parts of the Western world similar to that which confronted Daniel. As Christians, we are often bound to feel the same tension he felt as we face a world around us changing rapidly in its ethical and religious outlook and permitted customs. And that, if I may say, seems to be an accelerating process as well. The current of change, and this is the point, is so strong that it tends to swallow up anything that isn't firmly committed to another viewpoint. In other words, we need to be firm in our faith, or it will be overwhelmed. And for Daniel and his friends, that tension must have been at times almost palpable. Now, we don't have all the details of every issue they faced. They accept new names. Again, excuse me for going through all this. So new names are accepted. But as recorded in verses 8 to 16, they resolve not to take the king's food and wine. And there are three reasons why they may have decided not to do that. Firstly, the type of meat that they would have had on offer would have been things that they were commanded as Jewish people not to eat. Secondly, the manner in which the meat would have been prepared wouldn't have been kosher. And then thirdly, the food and wine would have been offered to idols, that's Babylonian gods, before being eaten. Now, we actually know, if we read the New Testament and look particularly at Acts chapter 15 and the Council of Jerusalem, that the food laws were later largely withdrawn, apart from the issue of abstaining from things offered to idols. Now, we may well not entirely understand God's reasons for having all the food laws in the Old Testament, but part of it, I think, was keeping Israel separate from the people around them. And there was an issue of draining blood. That was respect, I would say, for the issue of life, for us to remember that every time that we eat meat, an animal has died. Now, Daniel and his friends, they weren't going to be able to leave Babylon. They weren't going to be able to persuade the Babylonians to prepare food in the way that they would like it prepared. So I think that what Daniel probably objected to, and the reason he made his stand, was on the issue of offerings to idols. And he simply wishes to honour God, as we should in the ways that we behave as well. It's not physical defilement that he talks about, but defilement by the thoughts about the gods of Babylon. And Jesus says something similar in the New Testament. We're not defiled by what comes in, but by what goes out, what shows what we're like. Now, of course, you might regard that as unjustified speculation, but note that Daniel actually abstains from wine as well. There's nothing in the Old Testament say that he can't drink wine, other than he can't drink too much wine. Now, perhaps the important thing, though, is not exactly to determine why he made a stand, but the fact that he did make a stand, and the way in which he does it. Note that Daniel doesn't stand up in the Babylonian dining hall and shout and yell and say, "I'm not eating this." He doesn't demand alternative food as a right. and he's not at all aggressive or demanding. The Jewish commitment to God would have been very strange to the Babylonians, I think. Just as Christian faith, if you've shared it with any friends, can seem very strange to them. And Daniel tried to recognize that in his approach. I think we need to be at least aware of that, is that increasingly there are people there who just find our faith very odd indeed. We see once again that God is at work in this episode. Verse 9, God had caused the official, that's Ashpenaz, to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. And that brief conversation is revealing. And Ashpenaz confesses to Daniel his fear of the king, his fear of what will happen to him if Daniel suffers because he changes his diet. You can almost sense that he wants to say yes to Daniel. It's just fear causing him to say no. But Daniel doesn't give up. He proposes a test to the guard who actually serves the food. Now, the translation in the version that we read, and indeed in many versions as vegetables, is a little bit misleading. It would be better translated as pulse. So it was actually a mixture of vegetables and fruit. So actually quite a healthy vegan diet. Now, food science at the time certainly wasn't what it is now. It may well have been a healthier food than the food and wine from the king's table, we don't know. In any event, whether God needed to miraculously intervene or not, the test is successful. Probably, the guard had simply swapped his own food for theirs. So the guard was happy because he was having all this nice food, whether it was healthy or not, from the king's table. And everything was hidden. Nobody needed to know. If it needed to remain secret, it remained secret. And when we make our own necessary stand on issues, we should definitely note the gentle attitude, the sensible attitude of Daniel and his friends. But also note his persistence. He doesn't give up when Ashpenaz says no. And in doing so, Daniel was acting in the same way that Peter urges us, his readers, in 1 Peter 3:14, verse 16. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts regard Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet, do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. And the key is perhaps in verse 8, where there's this original resolve to not be defiled. And I'm pretty sure that, although we're not told, that Daniel and his friends must have prayed about this and about other matters. And if you read through the rest of Daniel, particularly the first six chapters, you'll see that prayer is a constant theme for Daniel and his friends. And they demonstrate that faith is not believing in spite of the evidence, but obeying in spite of the consequence. Hebrews 11 records that God would, on their behalf, quench the fiery flames and close the mouths of lions. So their commitment to God is honored as he acts for them, not only here, but later on as well. And this test on the matter of food and drink prepared them for future, much more threatening tests. And each test that we face can do the same if we respond in the same way that God directs. And then finally, in verses 17 to 21, we see that God honors the commitment they've made by these young men as they commit themselves to their studies. I'm quite sure that they worked and studied very hard. But we're also told that God gave them knowledge and understanding as well. Daniel himself is given a special ability to interpret dreams and visions. And we see in verse 18 that Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor of Babylon, takes a special interest in the studies of his students. They've outperformed all their fellows. They're better placed than all his existing advisors. And it's not just by a small amount. It's not just that they've scored a couple of points more. They're described as being 10 times better than everybody else. And it can surely only be the matters, the very constant matters of age and seniority that prevent them from being immediately placed as the equivalents of our cabinet secretary and our permanent secretaries. And in order to study the world around us, we too actually need to continually study. Be aware of what is going around us. Don't be ignorant. Don't turn away from it all because it's bad news. Don't get hung up on everything either. But don't just turn away and be unaware. Some Christians in the past, notably Tertullian, have asked, what has Athens to do with Jerusalem as they counseled holding back or withdrawing from the world? And that's quite a catchy little phrase, isn't it? And we might be tempted to echo that. But I don't see how we can engage with the world, how we can carry out the Great Commission of Matthew to the whole world if we don't understand the world. And there's also precedent for that in the New Testament. Read Acts 17. Paul uses his knowledge of the Greek poets, his investigations of the altars when he finds himself alone in Athens, to be a witness to the one living God. And Daniel and his three friends became skilled and powerful outsiders, not separated insiders. And when it was necessary, they refused demands of the Babylonians. They held to their faith in God. They did so despite the fiery furnace and despite the lion's den. And the question is whether we'll do the same. And there's no guarantee that God will do the same for them in similar situations. Will do the same for us as he did for them. But all the same, if you look at it, they didn't know in advance. They just made their stand. They did that regardless of whether his three friends in chapter 3, regardless of whether they were going to be burned to a crisp, and Daniel in chapter 6, regardless of whether he was going to be food for lions. The challenge is for us to trust in exactly the same way. And we never know what God is actually working out in his purposes. We cannot be sure what would happen if things were different. And it's at this stage that I want to get in my statutory Star Trek reference. So my favorite episode of the original Star Trek series is one where accidentally the chief medical officer, Dr. McCoy, goes back in time. And he changes something, and suddenly the Starship Enterprise is no longer there. So, of course, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, his first officer, have to go back and see what's happened. So they go back in time to the same time, and they find out what's happened. They find out that Dr. McCoy has actually done something which we might all do in the same circumstances. He's actually saved a young woman from being run over by a van in a traffic accident and dying. But in so doing, he saved somebody who then also does the right thing, in a way. She campaigns for peace. And she does so successfully that America delays its entry into the Second World War, and therefore Germany captures the world. We can never know how things will turn out. So when we perhaps get a bit fed up of things and we feel that we've got our second choice in everything or worse, remember that only God can see all those intricacies. And it's also for the long term. Verse 21 tells us that Daniel was still there, nearly 70 years later during the reign of Cyrus. He was forgotten for a while after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, but he made another great friend in Darius the Mede. For the moment, we leave the story there. But in summary, remember, God is in control. Work for the good of the place where we find ourselves, making a stand for God where necessary, but in a gentle and a tactful way, and trust God to work his purpose out through us and despite everything that comes our way. And then something just for you to think about for a moment before Tim comes up and leads our last song.